At Baptist Health, it's our mission to care for you when you're injured or sick and help you stay healthy and fit. Welcome to the Baptist Health Talk Podcast, where our respected experts bring you timely, practical health and wellness information to improve your family's quality of life.
The identification of breast cancer dates back over 1,000 years and is the world's most prevalent cancer. The dreaded C word is one that strikes fear too often in many souls, but the chances for survival are always improving. The past 20 years has seen advances in treatment regimens bringing hope for millions of women and their families. Here to talk to us about breast cancer is Dr. Louise Morrell, a medical oncologist and the medical director of the Lynn Cancer Institute at Boca Raton Regional Hospital, part of Baptist Health. And of course, I'm your host, Dr. Jonathan Fialco, Chief Population Health Officer for Baptist Health. Welcome to the podcast, Louise.
Thank you. Thanks, Jonathan.
So let's get right into it. First question is going to be a fairly straightforward one. What is breast cancer? And then as part of that, how is it staged and why is staging important?
So I like that question because I do think that whether a woman is even contemplating the possibility of breast cancer, meaning she has a mammogram with an abnormality, or hears those words of diagnosis, panic pretty much uniformly happens. And part of that panic can be alleviated by having a really good understanding of what's going on. And, you know, it's one of those parts of the body that's pretty invisible. If you're looking at something on your skin, you have a pretty good idea of what's happening. But when somebody tells you that there's a mass or something in your breast, that is very overwhelming thought, in part because people don't understand what it is or you don't know what it is. And also because the terminology is encompassing so many different things. So what I like women to understand, especially, is that this isn't a mystery and it's something they can understand. There is a milk duct. Inside the milk duct are cells that make milk. There's no other place in the body that can manufacture milk. So that makes it a totally unique cell. And that's the cell of origin. That's the cell that has decided to grow in an abnormal fashion, either filling up the duct or making some kind of a lump or some kind of a mass inside of it. So it's an abnormal growth of the duct cell that originates inside of the milk duct. And so what we need to do is tackle that, get rid of it, make sure it's not a problem. In terms of your second part of the question, that's important is that there's a lot of stages. So some breast cancer starts out right away as a cell that knows how to invade across that milk duct. So it ought to be only inside the milk duct. And so those are what we call invasive ductal carcinoma or invasive carcinoma. All that means is the cell knows how to break through the duct. And by the way, that's the most common or ordinary breast cancer. So most women, when they say they have breast cancer, that's what they're talking about. However,
what percent of breast cancers would be that kind of most common, if you have any statistics?
So if you think about the whole population of breast cancer, it can be about 2/3 are invasive, okay, and about 1/3 can be in situ, although in situ can only be diagnosed by mammogram because there's nothing to feel. So by in situ, I like to use the term inside the duct. So that's when the cells are growing just inside the duct, and those will show up as calcifications on a mammogram. And that's stage zero because that can't spread.
So the staging has to do with how far outside the origins, the origin areas of the cells, the cancer has spread?
Yes. I think that's a reasonably good way to summarize it. If it's completely inside the duct, it's in situ, it's stage zero. And at that point, there is no risk to the woman other than leaving it there and letting it become invasive. When it's invasive, then we look at the size. We look at whether it has traveled to the lymph nodes under the arm or right in the region. And those are stage 2 and 3. And then stage 4 is when it has spread to other parts of the body, like the liver, lung, bones, things like that. So 0 through 4 are the different stages.
So what I'm taking away is in one of the first parts of the conversation is the evaluation of a woman with breast cancer is very personalized. It's very customized. And when people say, oh, my friend had breast cancer, I have it. You don't really want to take another person's experience to what your situation is. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, I think not only is it a fair assessment, it's because breast cancer is so common, invariably you're going to know somebody who had breast cancer and you're going to leap to what you know, which is their experience. But there are a lot of women who have breast cancer that keep it very private, especially if all they needed to do was a simple surgical procedure or something different. Sure. So we're always remembering kind of the worst case scenarios.
So where do we stand in 2023, almost 2024, regarding recommendations for self-exam and mammograms? And maybe the caveat to that is, how do you find women with breast cancer most commonly present? How do we most commonly find it?
So most of the breast cancers we see are detected by imaging. So that means you need to be doing your mammogram. And if you have dense breasts, you need to be doing your ultrasound, because that's the majority, fortunately, of how we're finding breast cancers. And when we find it that way, it's clearly at an earlier stage or a better prognosis. Now, self-exam is not something we are emphasizing as much, because it maybe got too much emphasis in the past, but clearly, there are things that women should know if they notice a dimpling or a change in the shape of their breast, or if you feel a lump just when you're showering that's different than other parts of your breast. Don't ignore that. Don't say, well, I had my mammogram, it can't be anything, because some breast cancers do occur better or do show up more clearly as a detected by the woman finding. But our emphasis and our best tool is by doing that with screening tests such as mammogram and ultrasound.
Where do you find women have the best access for mammography? Is it are they able to schedule it themselves? Do they need a physician order through a primary care doctor, gynecologist? What would be, or maybe all of those, what do you find would be the most recommended pathways if a woman has not been receiving mammograms and now says, maybe from listening to the podcast, I want to get a mammogram and have imaging to determine if I may have breast cancer in an early stage?
So many centers like our own, like Baptist, like the Mammovans, especially in months like October, make sure that women know they can have a mammogram even if they don't have a doctor to prescribe it at that time. So if we've gotten away from having a primary care, gotten behind, you don't have to get behind on mammograms. You can self-refer, because those are accepted guidelines for everybody. But most people do have their mammograms performed after getting a prescription from their doctor and a little nudging there.
And that's helpful, though sometimes it is hard to get in to see a doctor, so we want to make sure that shouldn't wait. Going back to breast cancer, some further background information to maybe assess probabilities, or at least what we've learned. What is the genetic component or hereditary components? What's the role of genetics in the probability of a woman developing breast cancer?
So I think that almost every woman knows that if there's breast cancer in their family, that's going to have an impact on their risk. I think that the distinction is that there are some women who have a genetic inherited finding or abnormality that put them in an extraordinarily different risk. So very simply put, the average woman has about a 10% lifetime risk of getting breast cancer. If it's in your family, that number is generally 15 to 20.
How, I'm sorry to apologize, because again, I'm thinking through a cardiologist. How far a degree of separation in the family should count? An aunt would count, but would a third cousin, third removed? How do we have any information how far that genetic risk would be within a family member who may have breast cancer?
So the closer the family member, the more impactful it is on your statistics. When you get out to third degree relatives, so that's cousins or great-grandparents, that's going to have less of an impact. But the exception to that is that we now know that family history on father's side is also important.
Oh, wow.
And that's always going to be a second or third degree relative, since the father is so unlikely to have a breast cancer or a cancer related to a gene. So I think taking a little more extended family history, especially on the paternal side, is impactful.
Fascinating. Yeah, don't tend not to think about that. Then the other aspect would be, is there an age-related component to assessing a woman's risk? In other words, if my mother had breast cancer at 85, does that decrease my risk at a younger age? Or again, it doesn't really, not really relevant what time the family member may have had a cancer diagnosis.
So intuitively, yes, but not really. So
okay. Again, so I'm thinking as a cardiologist, so I apologize.
The only exception to that is if you're family member had breast cancer young, like say 40, then your risk of developing breast cancer is younger. So you should start mammograms at 30. So we still want to go 10 years younger than the youngest cancer. But if you only have it at an older age, it's not correct that you can say, oh, well, I'm, you know, 42, my family had it at 87. I don't have to worry about it. That's not correct.
So that's actually another great point, which is, so if I have a family history, what changes in the way I should receive my medical care, my prevention services? And as you say, you started at an earlier age in terms of screenings.
Yes, I think the young age is an important part of that. So let me go back a little bit to make this distinction between family history and risk. Normal risk is 10%, family history risk about 15 to 20%. That's the group where you want to start mammograms at 40, unless there's a young age. And then there's the group that actually has a hereditary mutation, such as
so
the
jump into that. Yeah, jump right into that. That was going to be a question, please.
And that group of women can have up to an 80, 85% lifetime risk of breast cancer. But more importantly, that breast cancer risk can start before age 30. So those women want to know they have the gene between 25 and 30, and they want to start their screening at that earliest age because their age of onset is substantially younger. So it's a small portion of the population that carries an inherited specific gene, but the risk is very, very high and it starts much younger. So we want to know that at a younger age.
So the BRCA gene is a blood test, right?
So the BRCA gene can be tested either on blood or on saliva, because in both cases, we're extracting the white cell and then extracting the DNA. So both of those samples can deliver, you know, any sample of your body,
sure,
give you your DNA. But the two places that we're doing this medical testing are in the white cells of saliva or on the blood, and both of them are reliable.
And similarly, as a genetic test, you only need to get it once. It doesn't change over the course of your life.
Correct. Your genes are the same from birth, but the testing now today involves anywhere from 25 to 40 genes, to be honest with you. Anything that was 23 genes or more is adequate. That changed around 2014. So women who tested negative before 2014 could repeat the test to include a wider number of genes, but their genetics have not changed. And they probably are only going to do that once, because we have a pretty big swath of genes right now.
Sounds reasonable. So the technology may change, but obviously the genetic makeup of the individual doesn't change. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about lifestyle. What are the identified lifestyle or environmental factors that can increase a woman's risk of breast cancer, specifically to assess their situation? And then the next question will be, what can women do to improve their risk by making lifestyle changes?
So the risk factors for developing breast cancer are pretty familiar, and some of them are things that we can impact and some of them that we can't. But the good news is that they align with every other healthy lifestyle. So having a diet that includes lots of vegetables, lots of grains, less fat, having a management of weight, all of those things are a consideration for breast cancer and also every other part of our health. Hormonal issues are a little more controversial. There's a whole list of things that help us calculate risk based on hormones, but the fractional difference of that impact is pretty small. We still would advise older women, meaning over 60, to not have ongoing hormone replacement therapy without a consideration of their risk of breast cancer. I'm not saying it's a definite no. I'm just saying that it can have an impact, and that should be looked at carefully in the context of their other risk factors. Exercise is a huge impact. And what people don't understand is that it's not a massive amount of exercise. 2 or 3 days a week of good walking, any other form of exercise in addition to that, lowers the risk of breast cancer by as much as anything else that we can do with medications or anything else. So those kinds of lifestyle changes are good for all of us and can impact breast cancer risk.
How about smoking? Alcohol, are they factors in breast cancer like they are in some other cancers?
So smoking has an impact, but it's not as great as other cancers like lung cancer and throat cancers and things like that. So we still would rather women don't smoke for all of those health reasons. But
sure.
In terms of alcohol, yes, there is definitely been a lot of evidence that shows excessive alcohol use increases the risk of breast cancer. We'd rather see people limiting it to less than a drink per day, on average, to at least minimize any impact that alcohol can have.
It's really fascinating in my experience, going back probably more than 15 years, you know, preventive cardiology, which we knew, but now it's coming out that it's the same, as you said, the same lifestyles are producing all these types of chronic diseases and whatnot. So obesity and that unhealthy lifestyle, you said, you know, processed foods, et cetera, it's heart disease and probably Alzheimer's and cancers. So right. You don't have to lead a lifestyle to prevent a cancer. You lead a lifestyle to prevent diseases that might be avoidable as we age. So again, well said. Couple of other quick questions in the interest of time. And again, this has been wonderful information that even I can understand. So I appreciate your means of articulating these points. What advances have you seen or that really have made a difference? You mentioned maybe a more sensitive genetic testing as an example. What have we seen? And maybe those advances, if you can answer in terms of what we know we can do, and if there's another part of it, which is what we've learned we don't need to do. What are the major advances in treatment options you've seen over the last, say, few years or decade?
Yeah, I think that the most exciting thing about being in this field is that if we consider all the components, screening, diagnosis, treatment, surgery, medical, prevention, all of them, every single one of those has seen benefits from the research and advances. So all the way up to, you know, having maybe in the past 3, 4, 5 medications that we could use, we probably have 30, 40 medications that we can use that are much more targeted, much more effective, much more successful. Even this year in mammograms, the use of artificial intelligence to not read the mammograms, but to aid the reader in reading them has resulted in a 20% increase in the number of breast cancers that we can detect. So every one of these advances contributes to this being a more manageable disease as we're going forward. Of course, genetics has changed that, even as we mentioned, our ability to identify who's at a higher risk, who should be doing screening at an earlier age, different kinds of screenings with MRIs and things like that. And so all of those together, even the lifestyle education and opportunities to get people up and moving, can diminish the impact of this disease.
Yeah, the AI impact in healthcare and imaging is already extraordinary, and it really is quite promising. And as you articulate, not to replace the human eye, but to add to what the human eye may not see or may not notice. And again, it's interesting to hear that you've already seen an impact in the breast cancer space. Can you articulate how survival rates have changed over, let's say, the last 10 to 20 years?
Well, the survival rates have improved, and I think most women diagnosed with breast cancer now can, even invasive breast cancer, can see a 90 to 95% long-term survival from that, and those were numbers that were unheard of. But the flip side is that we still see many women who are scared, and women who don't come in or who have even had an abnormality and are too frightened. And that is my biggest goal, is to understand that we can deal with you where you are, and we can address what are the things that are the biggest barriers to getting care taken care of, because it can vary from financial to cosmetic implications to just being afraid of medicine and cancer. We can deal with every one of that, no matter what stage it is. So I think that is something that I always emphasize with patients, that we want to get over that paralyzing fear, because we do see some people who have been afraid to come in even when they've noticed a problem.
Well said. And that goes back to our original point of, you know, personalize the woman's assessment of their risk, personalize the treatment plans. Don't bounce off of what you've heard from others, which might not be applicable to you. Two quick questions, which I want to ask again in the interest of time, not dealing with it. The first is, you mentioned that women with dense breasts would have an ultrasound added to the mammogram. Where is that assessment made? I'm seeing more ultrasounds done. Obviously, we would be doing it because it can increase the ability to pick up things that might be measured, missed elsewhere. Where do you see the role of ultrasound, and are the technologies changing at all in terms of screening for breast cancer?
So we have recognized for many years that the one way that a mammogram can let us down is when it basically looks like a snowstorm, or it's all white, and that is the dense breast. And that's just like somebody has freckles. I mean, there's nothing you can control about it. Just anatomically, some women have dense breasts and some women don't. That's the fibers, but it can hide something going on. And so just like a bush with a lot of leaves, you might not see something in there versus one that doesn't have leaves. So that's the role. And the mammographer, this is not something you can do. The mammography reading will always today in a standard fashion report out how much density is there, and therefore indicate what ultrasound is going to benefit that woman. That woman, you know, we are involved in a national study right now that is looking at using contrast in the setting of women who have, so iodine, using their mammogram, doing an injection of iodine, and that contrast mammogram may be as good as ultrasound. It's a clinical trial. So there is research occurring. It doesn't mean it is. It just, it's a research that's occurring that with all of these other advances side by side, we're now, hoping that can add. But every woman who has dense breasts reported out in their mammogram should be doing an ultrasound as part of their screening.
So the woman shouldn't necessarily insist on an ultrasound if they're told, hey, we had good images and we don't need it.
Okay. Yeah, no, it's not additive if there's not dense breast tissue.
Perfect. And again, there's so much information we're getting from the technology now as a cardiologist, and we see the breast calcification, the arterial calcification. So we're seeing able to pick up women at risk for heart disease and whatnot. So again, extremely valuable test. That's ubiquitous. Last question. What kind of breast findings are more common that might concern a woman that it could be cancer and it turns out not to be cancer?
Well, I think the most common is breast pain. So the vast majority of breast pain is related to nerve endings, is related to fibrocystic disease, so cysts, cycles in your period. And very rarely is it due to cancer. And most of the time when it's due to cancer, it is an obvious tissue invading kind of finding. And women get very nervous about that. That doesn't mean we don't work it up, because once in a while it can signal it. But most thing that women are most concerned about is breast pain. There's also benign growths in the breast that we absolutely know are benign, that have no predisposition to them. We don't need to operate and remove all of those kinds of findings. Those are something that the doctors and the radiologists have certainty once they can do a biopsy or by reading the imaging. So not every lump is a cancer, and not every pain is a cancer. These are things that are part of our anatomy, but it is part of the workup.
So the take-home point is, if a woman notices a change in her breast, whether it be painful or whether it be a skin change or whatnot, get checked out, although it's not necessarily guaranteed it's going to be cancer. And more importantly, perhaps, or more commonly, proper screening based on your individual risk is also the, if not the more important, impactful recommendation.
Well said.
Any final comments or anything you want to reiterate that was already stated that's of importance?
I think that our philosophy throughout the system is understanding there are a lot of experts in this area, and there are a lot of people who can help, whether it be the psychosocial, the recovery and the be beautiful and the hair issues, as well as the multitude of surgeons, and that we work as a team, that we actually talk to you, the person, the patient, as the center of the team, and then we work as a team with each other to make sure that all the information is helping to make a treatment plan. And that has also been a transformative approach to healthcare, I think, for breast cancer patients.
And I agree, and I think that's part of the Baptist Health philosophy. It's not about the disease, it's about the person. And I think, again, under your leadership, it's well evidenced in the Lynn Cancer Institute. So thank you very much, Louise. Again, very educational, very important, very articulate, and hopefully some of the listeners will make sure that they look at their own risk and they get themselves screened and or taken care of.
Right, John.
To our listeners, if you like what you've heard on this or any of our other podcasts, please be sure to tell a friend or a family member about us. And if you have a comment or a suggestion for a future topic, please email us at baptisthealthtalk@baptisthealth.net. That's baptisthealthtalk@baptisthealth.net. To our producer, Michael Justiz, I think a follow-up topic could be regarding hormone replacement therapy in women, and maybe Dr. Morell and will be a welcome guest to come back. Anyway, we'd love to hear from you, and thanks to all of you for listening.
Find additional valuable health and wellness information on our resource blog at baptisthealth.net/news. And be sure to interact with us on our social media channels for live and upcoming events. This podcast is brought to you by Baptist Health, the warmer side of care.